This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. The first time I got to chat with my next guest, Killer Mike. He was just coming off the release of his solo album, I Pledge Allegiance to the Grind. It was 2007. Now, 11 or 12 years later, he is still on the grind. He's half of the acclaimed rap duo Run the Jewels, alongside LP. He's become a well-known activist, campaigning alongside Bernie Sanders in the last presidential election, and now he has his own Netflix series. It's called Trigger Warning with Killer Mike. In the show, Mike takes on some of America's most complicated social issues. And as with everything Killer Mike, he never does it halfway. In the first episode, Mike tries to spend 3 days buying, using, and consuming products that have only come from the black community. It turns out that is really, really hard. In this scene, Mike rides his BMX bike, he can't find any black-owned car companies, to the black-owned Doggone Good Barbecue in Athens, Georgia. There he meets LP, the other half of his hip-hop duo, Run the Jewels. And at this point, Mike hasn't really had a meal in quite some time, so he is very excited to finally find something to eat that meets his rules.
Yeah, here you go. Black-owned restaurant.
Right? Black-owned, baby. Pro-black.
Black-owned produce and meat, probably, right, from a black farm.
What's up?
Excuse me, sir.
Yes, sir.
My white friend just reminded me I'm living so black that I'm technically only supposed to eat meat from a black farm or produce. Please tell me, like, this came from the West Georgia, like, Black Farmers Collaborative, or...
No, it didn't.
May I get a to-go box, please?
You're a good man, Michael Render, and I gotta be honest with you. It's really, really, honestly, some of the best barbecue that I've ever had.
Why are you still eating in front of me?
It's just that the hotel room that I was in last night, some of the room service, you know, the lobster,
You ate lobster?
I had a lobster roll.
I was on a park bench.
Yeah.
That is the literal definition of white privilege.
Yeah.
How's the macaroni? Mm. The only weed I've been able to find has been trash Mexican weed, which I can't smoke because it's Mexican.
Weed dealers aren't white. You can
the
get...
The growers are white. Like you guys gentrified marijuana.
Yeah, we're an unstoppable force.
That's what all the books say.
Yeah.
Killer Mike, welcome to Bullseye. It's nice to see you.
Now, how y'all doing? Then that's what all the books say actually comes from me reading Guns, Germs, and Steel.
I feel like that was the line of the show. I watched a number of episodes and I kept thinking back to that's what all the books say.
I want to get a t-shirt made to say white people won. Stay woke. You know?
Well, Mike, I'm so happy to have you on Bullseye. I looked it up. The last time I interviewed you was on the phone, and it was, I was thinking 5 or 7 years ago, but it was actually 12 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So I guess what have you been up to?
Funny thing. I started have yet to finish a series of undergrounds called I Pledge Allegiance to the Grind. I made it up to Pledge 3. Then I made rap music with this interesting guy named LP from Brooklyn, formerly of Company Flow. And we developed a friendship and bond that seems to be unbreakable and dropped 3 classic duo albums, Run the Jewels 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, by my superstition, you have to be 4 classic albums in before you're officially a group. And that's worthy of being talked about. So we're working on Run the Jewels 4 and securing our place in mythological, you know, rap music history. And
so how did you end up in Run the Jewels? Because Run the Jewels is aesthetically very different from the records that you were making the last time I interviewed you.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone who's been born is better equipped to rap over LP beats than me. And I think that it was just a matter of me and LP finding one another. And you know how in any mythology, the hero must go on this this journey or this quest, and you end up finding yourself as you burn off old things, you know. I think that when I came in the music industry, I had a feeling about the music I wanted to make. Because even the stuff I made that got me my deal was more in lines of Run the Jewels than the stuff you ended up hearing me make in the beginning. But I think it was about finding my way to it. And me, Elle and I finding ourselves in a way where once we found each other, we were absence of ego, absence of expectations, and just kind of open to make dope.
You're also grown adults.
Yeah, exactly. But that's where the ego and the expectation. Like when you're young, you have expectations and your ego is often getting in the way of your creativity and your growth. So yeah, we were adults, 35 years old.
I mean, LP had run a record label that put out some really important records.
Yeah, absolutely.
The record label was done. You had been signed to a major, put out a record on a major. You started your own record label. Like you had been through
the underground.
You've been through the ringer by then.
Yeah. And when you get there, you know, it's like Clyde Drexler going to Houston. Like, I've spent all this time being great in Portland, and nobody was watching Trailblazer ball at that time. And now I'm in Houston. And now
Do
I'm
not
a ball.
Speak ill of Kevin Duckworth.
No, yo, I got no problem with the Trailblazer. I'm just simply saying Drexler in Houston brought those rings home, you know. And Run of Jewels is that. We are kicking left and right. That's what we're going to continue to do, hopefully, the rest of our careers.
How did you meet LP?
I knew of his work in Perithial. But and I think it's important to clarify, like, I love East Coast, the sound of East Coast. All hip-hop nerds, you know, our homage goes back to East Coast music. So it wasn't hard for me to love his music and stuff once exposed. But we had a mutual friend in Jason DeMarco, who's a fan of both of us, and he works at Adult Swim. And he put us together. He gave me an opportunity to make rap music, to essentially just make the music I always wanted to make without commercial expectation. Just make the record you always wanted to make. LP was supposed to do 3 beats. I got in. I rapped over 3 beats. I decided this guy's supposed to be producing for me. He was making an album. I was like, "F that shit. You're producing my whole album too."
I mean, it's hilarious that this first record, there was this weird period where Adult Swim, television network, mm-hmm. a television sub-network.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah. Half of a television network. Yeah. I remember they put out a Witch Doctor album.
Yeah.
But I was like utterly baffled at the idea that the guys from Squidbillies, no offense to Squidbillies, it was funny, were like, oh yeah, and also we're trying to bring Flying Lotus around.
Well, Jason is amazingly good at picking TV programming, right? But Jason has a musical ear that's amazing. You know, Jason is, he's diverse in his listenership. And because he's a pure fan and he doesn't have any aspiration of being a music executive, he only puts together this stuff because it's dope. You know, he put Killer Mike and Flying Lotus together when we did Swimming. He put me and LP together and thought, you guys could potentially make something dope. So, you know, I say that just to say to all the fans out there, like your dreams, your imaginations, you know, they come true. So follow whatever you're passionate about, whatever you're good at. And if you get an opportunity to hook up a super producer, an amazing rapper, do that too. Because Jason did it without expectations. He just did it. And now you have Run the Jewels.
When your first album came out and didn't do very well.
Yeah.
Was there a time when you thought you might have to find something else to do with your life?
Well, relatively speaking, not do very well in the early 2000s is selling like 300,000 to 500,000 records, and 50 Cent sells 10 million records.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So not doing very well 15 years removed is amazing. You know, accelerating artists going gold again. But, you know, for me, what I considered is maybe I'm not built for this commercial rap. You know, I was going to be a rapper. It's all I wanted to do. And because I went to Texas and met people like Lil Flip and Hump, Paul Wall and Chameleonaire, Slim Thug, and I saw that independently, you could make your way. Now, what I wasn't prepared for was the death of CDs, the increase of streaming and stuff, but I can say things like MySpace, Facebook, later IG, Twitter, have helped me in my independent career and to grow. So I knew I was going to be rapping, and when I wanted to quit, my wife was like, this is what you were put on earth to do, and you're going to keep doing it. So for the 2 years, I got really down and really beat up and depressed, you know, didn't get out of bed and didn't take full advantage of it. It was doing, you know, it was just having a great wife that was kicking me in my ass saying, you got to do this. And that's what brought us to Pledge Allegiance to the Grind 2, Pledge Allegiance to the Grind 3, and later rap music.
Speaking of MySpace, how much of your success would you attribute to having your interview with me from 12 years ago up on your MySpace for a long time?
Lots of it. You know, lots
probably
of
like, I'm not going to say a majority, but like 30%, right?
Yeah, in the early days, man, that you know, having those things are big looks. Like people don't understand how much the interview and how much people who are on that side of the mic that are firm believers and help use their platform to expose the talent, what it does. If it wouldn't have been for those interviews and if it wouldn't have been for things like MySpace and what I call the Pledge Heads, people that have followed my career all the way through the Pledge Allegiance series until Run the Jewels, then I wouldn't be here. So I'm very appreciative for those days. I'm very appreciative for that core group of fans in particular.
When you went to college, which you did for, what, a year, year and a half, something
yep,
like
yep,
that?
Yep, yep.
Did you think that your career was going to be as an MC, or did you think
I wanted to be. I mean, I dropped out in chase of the rap thing. You know, once I got attached to Big Boy and them and I knew I could do it, I decided to pursue it full speed. But I shouldn't have done that. I should have stayed in college because I ended up getting a deal around the same time I would have graduated. So that, if I have a regret, that's regret. I went to Morehouse. I'll let you guys Google that. It's a pretty prestigious college. So, you know, I should have stayed in, but I didn't. And with that said, you know, I can go back and I will, but I should have stayed in. So the kids that are out there that are passionate about it and that are smart enough to get into it, stay. And not just because of the education you get or saying that's going to save you, the networking opportunity you have in college, the people you're going to meet and where they're going to go. You know, if you're good to them and you build good networks, it just makes your transition to whatever you're going to do easier.
How did you meet Big Boy?
I met Big Boy because his good friend went to Morehouse also, CeeLo Reddick from Savannah, and his brother went to Morris Brown, and we were all little homies, and we all wanted to make music too, and we were trying to impress James's big brother.
Well, I can imagine you were trying to impress him. He was basically certainly the king of Atlanta hip-hop at the time, and yes, one of the kings of hip-hop
Southern
in the
hip-hop
world.
Period, yeah, at that time, yeah. And he still is. Big Boy has not stopped working. At this point, his solo career is longer than his Outkast career. You know, that's amazing when you think about it. You know what I mean? I'm incredibly impressed by his work ethic, and you know, he employs over 100 people, you know, and through touring and through all in studio and things of that nature. Like, he's one of the most focused businessmen and MCs I've ever come across, and I try to model much of myself after him.
Did you pass him a tape or a CD, or did you
no,
give him some bars in person?
He had me freestyling, and I wasn't pressuring him. I was pressing up my own stuff, working my butt off, and Rock D, the guy who brought Kryptonite to Big, is an amazing MC. He's also the guy that you hear on the end of Kill Jill doing a little pattern. You know, hold up, listen. Just like I told Coco, my flow is pimping. That's Rock D. Me and Rock D were messing around freestyling. And Big was getting his hair braided by Princess from Princess Palace Braiders. And he was like, yo, I like you. And I'm going to give you a deal. And I was like, I appreciate it, bro. And I was like, I still got a pound of weed in my trunk I got to sell. You know what I'm saying? I went back to focusing on that. And, you know, like a year or two later, he called me. Like, hey, I really want to do it. Let's get it.
How old were you, like 20?
Might have been 23, 24.
I mean, 23 or 24 is old for a rapper getting a deal.
Yeah, definitely was then. Now, not so much. But, yeah, by then, because what they do is they sign you at 24 and tell the world you were 22, 21. But, you know, I didn't care how old I was. Like, I don't care now. I don't think about my age. I've had that discussion with Stax before, me and Dre talked. Him just saying, you know, I'm just trying to see what these younger guys are doing. Just, you know, it's and he'll feel, you know, a certain way sometimes. You know, he said, I'm just like, man, I don't feel no way. But, like, when I get in the room, I want to have the dopest style in the room, you know. So my whole thing is I guess I've avoided thinking about my age because I've always wanted to style. You know, if you hear me on different tracks, different features with different peoples, I probably am one of at least the top 10 rappers in terms of being able to style flip, depending on what beat. You know what I mean? And I've always taken pride in that because it's not easy. So for me, age kind of dies with style. Like E-40 is ageless to me because his style is ageless. Like
you're
can't,
pandering to me now. But
nah,
go ahead.
Nah, 40 Watt is what's up. Like I'm from Atlanta. Like Atlanta is the Bay Area part deuce. Like you understand? Like Too Short, 40, you know what I mean? Like we grew up on this on some player shit. So for me, like, his style is literally timeless. You know what I mean? Scarface, who I've considered the greatest rapper of all time, style is timeless. So that's what I would rather be, timeless, than really think about age.
When you came out with Outkast. Big Boi signed you. You won a Grammy for one of the first records that you made that came out.
Yeah.
An Outkast song.
Yeah.
That must have been incredibly heady because that was Outkast at the height of their artistic and commercial powers both.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was a trip, you know, because, you know, you have to reconcile this is not your record. So the Grammy, you're on. But with that said, I recognized I wasn't just a benefactor of good luck. I ripped that verse.
You sure did.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I remember being in my dorm room watching MTV2.
Yeah.
It had the music videos on it.
Yeah.
Watching that video and was like, oh, who's that dude? He just ripped it.
Yeah. I was very proud of myself then and now. I wish I would have went to the ceremony then because I won and we didn't because I think Jay-Z had us protesting that year because they weren't showing the rap division. And then when I went to the Grammys last year, because we were nominated for the Chase Me song, we didn't win. So when I didn't go, I won. When I went, I didn't win. That was really sad.
More from my conversation with Killer Mike after a quick break. We'll talk about why he supported Bernie Sanders and the state of politics in America. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. And you'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com, to try Babbel for free.
The world is complicated, and for many of us, history class was a long time ago.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's first history podcast.
Find us wherever you like to listen.
If you're looking for a new comedy podcast, why not try the Beef and Dairy Network? It won Best Comedy at the British Podcast Awards in 2017 and 2018. Also, ILO.
There were no horses in this country until the mid to late 60s.
Specialist bovine arse vet.
Both of his eyes are squid's eyes.
Yogurt buffet.
She was married to a bacon farmer who saved her life.
Farm-raised snow leopard.
Download it today. That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast from MaximumFun.org. Also, maybe start at episode 1 or, weirdly, episode 36, which for some reason requires no knowledge of the rest of the show.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest this week is Killer Mike. He's half of Run the Jewels with his partner LP. His latest project, Trigger Warning with Killer Mike, is on Netflix now.
When you started working with LP, what was it that clicked for the two of you?
Just listen to me on his beats. That's what it is. It sounds like it's supposed to be. You know, it's like Ice Cube over Sir James beat. It's like hearing Chuck over Bomb Squad beat or even Cube over Bomb Squad beat. It just fits. I don't know why, and I don't waste time questioning why. I don't know why I love my wife more than any other woman I've ever loved. You know, I just know there's something so special about her, I can't not love her like that. So I don't question those mysteries. I just go and you know, hopefully one day it won't, you know. I mean, hopefully it'll never stop. And if it ever does, we're just going to have the most fantastic run we've ever had, you know.
Were you surprised at how well it worked? You must have just thought this was just like
the first day.
Cool thing you were doing.
Once he played big beats for me first, and he played another couple beats, and I knew then, like, this guy's supposed to be making beats for me for the rest of my life. I knew. Like, I fell in love instantly. It was like me and my wife. I knew within 2 weeks of knowing her, like, I want to marry you. Now, she said no, and we spent 2-3 years breaking each other's hearts, you know what I mean? But with me and Eld, at first he was like, I can't do it. I got to do my own album. I'm like, B, you got to do this album. And I aggravated the heck out of him for 90 days, him and Jason, till he succumbed and just said, all right, I'll do the record.
Were you surprised at the number of white people showing up for your work?
Well, I seen it
at that point. I'm a white person, and some of us were showing up before.
Yeah, and I'm going to definitely say I was definitely encouraged by your whiteness. Like, I had learned from Outkast that, you know, the people who you most look like or who like you or who you're making the music or that even inspire the music you're making, they're valuable to you because they're there. That's what makes you, your community, you know, grows you, your village, right? But who appreciates you, you have no choice in. You gleefully accept that appreciation and you sing, rap, and dance your off while you have the chance because you're lucky enough to have this job, right? So as much as the South loved 3-6 Mafia and as dope as Paul and Juicy are, you know, I don't know if we'd hear the sounds that are imitating 3-6 Mafia now if it wasn't for the white hipster crowd in Williamsburg that somehow rediscovered them, and all of a sudden you'd be walking into Max Fish hearing Project Pat in 2013, where I know I can hear Pat in Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, North Florida, but I didn't know Pat was playing in Williamsburg, you know what I mean? So you love who loves you, and my audience, no matter what color, race, creed, or religion they are, if they're rocking with the raw, dirty that's hip-hop that me and L do, then that's fine by me. You know, it doesn't matter to me what color you are. I still love you. If you love Wu-Tang and Outkast as much as I do, we probably can kick it, you know?
When you were campaigning with Bernie Sanders
in
a couple of years ago when he was running for president, I found myself, when you first started campaigning with him, I found myself thinking, like, where did this come from?
There was a DJ in his campaign. And when they were asked about getting black influences from the music world, this DJ, I can't remember his name, I'll save my life, unfortunately, but he was adamant about them checking out Killer Mike. You know, so the work, you know, spoke for me, and he spoke up for me, and Senator Sanders, and I have to give a lot of credit to Cornel West at the time, who was a part of it, who co-signed me, and a bigger just shout of thanks and gratitude to former Senator out of Ohio, Nina Turner, who now leads our revolution. She is a Shirley Chisholm of our time. She's an absolutely dynamic politician and advocate on the behalf of the people, one of the more powerful organizers and mobilizers I've ever seen, and should be nationally talked about by people who are members of the Democratic Party, and I don't understand why she's not. But I'm going to do, you know, everything I can to yell her name. But she's a person that really kept me engaged. After I saw, you know, the DNC sabotage what I thought was a campaign that could have defeated Trump, after I've seen them make, you know, poor decisions afterwards, you know, in terms of if you want to accept him in your party or not, or you like him or not, you can't say he didn't electrify the Democratic vote in millennials. You can't say that his policy has not affected the greater fabric. It has in everything from marijuana law to the raising of minimum wage across the nation, as we're seeing, and to a grander push for Medicare for all. So the OG knew what he was doing. And I think that Senator Turner was a very big part of the reason I stayed engaged and is a very big part of the reason I'm still engaged locally and nationally. So I look for her, hopefully, to do something. You know, I don't know what's next, but she's one of the people who I admire, Senator Sanders. I, like everyone else within our revolution, would love to see him run again in 2020. I don't think anyone else is going to beat the current guy in there. I think to put out fire, you need water. You know, I think that the only way you get Magneto out of office is have Professor X, you know. So we'll see what happens.
I think a lot of people see in that movement the possibility that issues having to do with race, issues having to do with the unique experiences, particularly being African-American in this country, but any ethnic category other than white certainly can be subsumed into class rhetoric and ignored. Was that something that you were worried about?
It's something I worry about because we are allowed to argue race in this country because race is polarizing and we all belong to a tribe, right? So whether you're ethnic white, you know, or black or a descendant of a slave African-American or an African-American that's an immigrant, you get chopped up in all these things that cause these extreme arguments. But if we spent as much time talking about John Brown in schools as we do Robert E. Lee, how would relationships between black and white kids who are both poor in West Virginia be different? Or in Ohio be different? How does that start to change? How does solidarity start to change amongst people who don't look like each other? And how does that change for government? Are people harder to control when they understand, yes, we're different? When people say, well, I don't look past race or I don't see race, I don't hear. Yeah, that's a lie. I don't look past race. I see a white man in front of me with a glorious beard and hair maxes on.
You also have a glorious beard.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. But I also see an ally. You know what I mean? And that's what matters most. You know, if we are at war for our very freedoms and lives, no war is won without allies. And to too tightly cling to my tribe and the tribalisms that we have makes me less likely to be cooperative and collaborate with others that also have my best interests or the better interests of us all. So I try my best not to let it get in the way. I worry that we all let it get in the way too much. And instead of arguing issues of class that can be won by us all, we end up all suffering more because we get baited into something that's race. That, you know, it feels like race because I'm black, but it also is going to feel like poverty, you know, if you're North Georgia and white. You know, it all is unfair either way. But I can't think just because it's my tribe, it's us, just us. We all serve the same masters. We all have the same enemies.
Outside our studio, behind my desk, you know, 6 feet from here,
yeah,
is a poster that my mom bought me at the flea market for Dick Gregory's presidential campaign.
Okay.
Dick Gregory, who was
my friend.
One of the most important stand-up comics of the 1960s.
Yes.
Quit show business.
Yes.
And spent the next 50 or so years.
Yes.
As an activist.
Yes, 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 yes. I got a chance to see him thanks to my sister, Zoe, who's like a sister to me. She's a amazing woman. She's a lesbian woman out of Chicago. Amazing. She manages stand-up comics and acts. And she had me and T.I. get on the phone with him about 3 years ago. He cursed us out really badly. Tip hung up, called me back later, say, what did he say? I was like, man, he cursed out bad. But we went to see him at a show. I befriended him, and for the last 3 years of his life was a very good friend. And one of the most wise and smart and brilliant men, and personally knew Malcolm and Martin and Megger, and was just about the work of freeing people, and not just black people, but freeing people's minds. And like Carlin, like Bruce, like Bill Hicks, like Pryor before him, I mean, a lot of those people aren't even before him, but just also comedians, he did a lot more to enlighten me that it's easier to teach people. Because I saw him when he started coming back and doing some comedy. Zoe was actually handling him, taking him around. Trigger warning, I knew it would work. Even though I was nervous, I knew it would work when people understood Mike is funny. He's satirical. He has a subversive sense of humor. And he's, you know, people who know me, you know Michael, know he's always saying this. He's always pushing the line by saying what if. If I knew if people got that part, it'll work. So I'm thankful for Mr. Gregory for showing me that through an example. You know, by watching him, I got a chance to just see him in regular conversation. He'd say stuff and it just opened your mind like, oh. And that's all I want to do with the show, to get people to create conversation and to be open from different perspectives.
Well, Mike, I'm so grateful to you for taking all this time to be on Bullseye. It was nice to see you.
Oh, man, I love the show. Thank you.
Come back anytime.
All right, love.
Killer Mike, rapper, actor, activist, host of Trigger Warning with Killer Mike, now on Netflix. I'm so glad that dude is still making power moves all these years in. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org world headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where Raghu, our fill-in producer, saw a lady feeding the birds and ducks in the middle of a thunderstorm, which really gives the lie to that idea that people in L.A. can't handle the rain. I also saw either a teen or a tween throwing two heavy bags into the lake, and I have no idea what was inside them. No idea. There were a lot of theories in the office, but we could not come up with any definitive answers. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He's lollygagging around in Italy, so Raghu Manavalan filled in for him. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We got help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow at MaximumFun.org is Shayna Deloria. Our interstitial music comes to us from Dan Wally, a.k.a. DJW. Thanks, as always, to Dan for sharing it. Our theme song comes from The Go Team. Thank you to them and to their label Memphis Industries, who let us use that music for free. We will be forever grateful. And did you know that we have been making this show for literally over 1,000 years? Maybe not literally over 1,000 years, but like almost 20 years. And all of our shows are on our website at MaximumFun.org. You can also find many of them on our YouTube channel. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, YouTube. You can find
lots of cool updates and new show announcements and stuff like that on Facebook if you like Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And you can find us on Twitter at Bullseye. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology, hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why people do the things they do. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.